Today at Reader's Corner, Douglas Brinkley, author of The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America.
When Theodore Roosevelt was president, 1901 to 1909, he saved 234 million acres of wild America, mostly in the West. TR did not want to see places like the Sawtooth Mountains or the Salmon River or all these great scenic places. He did not want to see them just spoiled and ruined and crassly commercialized. Congress tried to rein him in. They thought he was getting national forest drunk. He was doing nothing less but trying to create a wilderness democracy.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. With summer vacations in the not-too-distant future, many of us are looking forward to camping, boating, hiking, or just relaxing in the great outdoors. It's a fitting time to remember President Theodore Roosevelt, who helped lay the early groundwork for the idea of wild places as a national treasure. His dedication and perseverance led to the preservation of some of our greatest national parks, forests, monuments, and wildlife sanctuaries that some states are now challenging. Today's guest, Douglas Brinkley, details Roosevelt's contributions to preserving our wild places in his book, The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. It's now out in paperback. The Wilderness Warrior spans the life of our 26th president from his early days as a sickly child in New York City through his adventures as a rough rider in Cuba and his many years in public service. At the heart of the book is Roosevelt's expansive knowledge about wilderness and the natural world, and his dedication to educating the populace about the intrinsic value of wild places. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Douglas Brinkley. He is a professor of history at Rice University, a CBS News historian, and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Seven of his books have been named New York Times Notable Books of the Year. Last fall, I had the privilege of welcoming Dr. Brinkley to Boise State University, where he presented the keynote address at the 31st Annual Frank Church Conference on Public Affairs. Dr. Brinkley joins us by phone for this interview. Douglas Brinkley, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we're excited to have you as well, and let's dig right into this book, over 800 pages long. I'll start at the very back of the book. You have three maps at the back of the book that really sum up what Theodore Roosevelt managed to pull off here. One map is of federal bird reservations and natural game preserves. One map is of national forests. And the third map is the national parks and national monuments. What you take away from these three maps, with the exception of Florida and some areas around the Gulf Coast, is the incredible focus and commitment Theodore Roosevelt had in the West. I mean, is there any doubt about the fact that his legacy really is a Western legacy?
I completely agree with that. You know, Theodore Roosevelt was born in 1858, and his father was a very wealthy man in New York City, and his mother was from the South. Well, when I say 1858, that tells you the Civil War was about to start. Well, in the Roosevelt family home in downtown New York City, they fought terribly because Dad wanted Ulysses S. Grant and Lincoln, and the mom wanted Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis. Well, young T.R. found redemption in the West. He started focusing as a boy on the West. There was a famous, in 1871, Hayden expedition to Yellowstone, and for the first time, photographs were appearing in Boys magazine showing the natural features of Yellowstone or the Colorado Plateau, the Red Rock Wilderness of Utah, on, and he just became enamored with it, and he just became enamored with the whole region. And as I write about in my book, famously, when he lost on the same day his wife giving childbirth and his mother, they both died in the same house on the same day. He wrote a big X in his diary, "The life has gone out of my life forever." And he was so depressed, he took the Northern Pacific Railroad and got off in the Dakota Badlands and started spending years as a wilderness wanderer all over North Dakota, Montana, and was even wrote up about his time spent in Idaho.
In his early days of his presidency, or throughout his presidency, really, as he tackled some of these tough issues in the West and establish some of these national parks, there seemed to be some themes running through them. There was always a local activist of one kind or another, either devoted to the land or devoted to species preservation, who found Theodore Roosevelt's ear. And your book does a great job of helping us understand who they were, because unless you're from that local area, you really have forgotten or you never knew who these folks were. Then there was Theodore Roosevelt himself, who was writing roughly over the interest of Congress or either ignoring Congress. And then there was always opposition from the locals. And the opposition from the locals is what I found interesting. Today, if anybody would ever say that, well, you know, the Seattle mayor is going to oppose Mount Rainier National Park, you'd say, huh? And yet that seemed to happen over and over again. Must have had something to do with the local economy and maybe even timber.
Well, boy, exactly. Look, when Theodore Roosevelt was president in 1901 to 1909, he saved 234 million acres of wild America wilderness, mostly in the West. His great concern was he had traveled abroad and saw deforestation, and he saw it in Palestine and in Italy and in Greece. And he, conversely, you go to Germany, they had a sane forest program. So he was very worried about the West just getting clear cut without replanting. And the TR conservation is for every tree cut, you plant one or two more for the future. You just can't cut and run. And yet the West had been seen as a place by the beginning of the 20th century where people only were looking to extract from the land. How much ore can we get? Zinc, copper, asbestos, you know, timber. And Roosevelt said, no, this isn't the best part of America. We've got to create a new society in the West where we have cities like Boise surrounded by a greenbelt of national forest, and you do sustainable living. You're going to have to build the Western American states for long-term use. You have to take them out and mine water power and the limitations of resources. And it's very hard to teach people that North America wasn't endlessly forested. And so Roosevelt became a bit of an educator on all of this, and he wrote his first book, was called The Summer Birds of the Adirondacks. So he was really keen into bird life and all animal life, and he would get reports from people, and he would try to do what was seen. So, for example, he created our country's first game reserve in Wichita and also in Montana to preserve the bison, which had almost been slaughtered out of existence in the Great Plains. And he would do this for species all the time. He was very keen on saving the antelope in the West. And he would cut right to it. And he said, you know why we save them? Because they're beautiful. We want them in our backyard. And he often sold what we might consider environmental policy today. He sold it with saying, I'm a hunter. And any real hunter has to have a conservation sense. You just can't slaughter all the game. So he would call people by names in the West, land rapists, land skinners, slob hunters, a kind of language that really put down the people that he felt weren't being good land custodians.
Well, out there in the Olympic Range in the far northwest, they actually named the elk after him, the Roosevelt elk, and that seemed to have played a role, according to your book, in his getting involved in Mount Olympus and it becoming Olympic National Park. But I love these little twists of history. And the little twist of history here that I'll have you explain is how, in fact, his original dedication of 600,000 acres changed a bit under Wilson, and it took his distant cousin FDR to do something about it.
Yes. And well, just let's take the what you're suggesting in the state of Washington. 48 hours before he left the White House, Theodore Roosevelt created Mount Olympus National Monument. Now, the monuments could be done by an executive order. They still can be done that way. George W. Bush recently did a monument executive order for Hawaiian Islands. But T.R. had done it for the Grand Canyon and saved it. He saved Redwoods in California. He saved Devil's Tower in Wyoming. And he decided we had to start saving in Washington State. So he declared this Mount Olympus National Monument, saved all the Roosevelt elk. But it started becoming that the deal wasn't done because the Olympic Peninsula, all the great rainforest up there were starting to get destroyed. And it wasn't until Franklin Roosevelt becomes president that they moved to create Olympic National Park, combining TR's original monument with a bunch of national forest lands, and then the Interior Department created what they wanted to be a major National Park in the Pacific Northwest. FDR also was a progenitor of the Great Smoky Mountains, another major park in the eastern forest.
You're listening to Douglas Brinkley. He's the author of The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. And you mentioned by executive order. Help us understand the Antiquities Act. I believe it was 1906. How did this act come about? He obviously signed it, but isn't this really what he used as the tool to act unilaterally across the West?
Yes, because what happened was for a national park, you have to get congressional approval. So TR did that as president. For example, Crater Lake in Oregon is a TR national park, went through Congress, people agreed on it, so there wasn't a lot of acrimony at that point. But when he visited the Grand Canyon, he stood on the lip of the Grand Canyon and said, "Do not touch it. God has made it. You will only mar it. Leave the Grand Canyon alone." And a few years later, the Senate was voted to mine the Grand Canyon for zinc, asbestos, and copper. So refusing to be defeated or flummoxed, TR resurrected what was known as this Antiquities Act of 1906, which a congressman, John Lacey, a Republican from Iowa, was running the General Land Office in Congress. He was able to get this done really for smaller parcels, kind of archaeological dig sites that the government, in the name of science, now had a right, a president had a right to claim a place, a national monument. Well, TR applied what maybe was meant for 60 acres to 600,000 acres at the Grand Canyon. Today it's over 1 million acres. And that started in motion using federal executive power for national monuments. And TR would use it again and again. And he set a precedent because all presidents after him started using the Antiquities Act too. And now it gets very fiercely debated. Because, as you know, in Idaho, everybody wonders what land designation makes a difference. If the Sawtooths were a national park today, you would not be allowed to go hunting. But the Sawtooths is a wilderness, you're allowed to go hunting. So, you know, all of these western lands, whether it's BLM, national forest lands, national grasslands, on and on, what national wildlife refuges, they all have different laws, and TR used that monument because he was the president-elected executive power. He just simply bypassed Congress.
You also had something in your book about Niagara Falls, where he put a little pressure on Canada?
You see, Niagara Falls was very important because it is so spectacular, but it really got terribly maligned. It became commercialized and abused, and TR did not want to see places like the Sawtooth Mountains or the Olympics or the Salmon River or all these great scenic places. He did not want to see them just spoiled and ruined and crassly commercialized. And so it was a learning lesson, and he applied that to the West and said, let's not turn Yosemite into Niagara Falls. Let's not turn the Grand Canyon into that. Let's treat these as public heirlooms. And TR's belief in wilderness was, that's what makes the American different. He had gone to Europe and had climbed the Matterhorn and saw no game, no wildlife, a kind of manicured mountain range. And he said, my goodness, in the Rockies or in the mountains, the forests of the West, it's the wilderness that defines the American spirit. And hence, we've got to save some of this wilderness. Even if you don't go explore it, it'll help with water protection, it'll help with soil erosion, on and on, and that he kept using the word heirlooms, that these places that you have in Idaho are heirlooms. You may be making minimum wage and struggling and to pay your bills, but at least if you have kids, you know 50 years from now, they're going to get to enjoy the Idaho wild just like you did.
What I learned from The Wilderness Warrior is that you give lots of credit to these naturalists and conservationists who find Roosevelt. In fact, I'm sure the word gets out in any region of the country. Once they see something happening in one neck of the woods, it's like, well, we can probably get his attention. John Muir certainly was someone who influenced Roosevelt. And in one case, he succeeded, Muir Woods, but in another case, he didn't when it comes to getting water to San Francisco. Tell us about that story.
Well, Theodore Roosevelt made a famous Western Loop tour, and because he was a cowboy and a rancher in the Dakotas and a wilderness person, he always really claimed he was a man of the West, our first Western president. But he went with John Muir camping in Yosemite National Park, and they had a marvelous time together. And T.R., upon leaving those days of camping with Muir, ended up saving Mount Shasta in California at Muir's suggestion. And he also increased the size of Yosemite Park, and it included Mariposa Grove, the great redwood trees. However, in 1906, San Francisco had its mighty earthquake, and it was really the fire that killed. Everybody talks about the earthquake of 06, but it was the fire that resulted from the quake that burned all of San Francisco, the whole Bay Area, down to the ground. And so it happened really after Roosevelt left office, but there became a movement to build a Hetch Hetchy dam in California, which would to flood a valley, not the main valley tourists go to today, but another part of the Park Valley, as a reservoir to use for a water supply for San Francisco. And it became a hugely heated debate between two friends of Theodore Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, former head of the Forest Service, versus Muir. And Roosevelt kind of stayed mute on it. He didn't side with anybody because he was concerned and thought San Francisco needed its water supply. So some environmentalists will feel T.R. betrayed them over the Hetch Hetchy instance, even though, in fact, he wasn't president when that all went down. It took place finally with Woodrow Wilson as president.
What role did he play in protecting the four corners of the Southwest?
Oh, boy, that was a great love of his, is the Four Corners. And after he did the Grand Canyon, he then declared the National Monument and Rainbow Bridge. And in fact, Franklin Roosevelt's Interior Secretary, Harold Ickes, who was a slavish follower of Theodore Roosevelt, had run his third-party Bull Moose campaign out of Chicago. Ickes wanted to create a massive national monument from the Navajo Reservation all the way up to Moab, which would have encompassed this vast protection of canyon lands and the, as I mentioned, Red Rock Wilderness Zone there on the Colorado Plateau. But T.R. worked to, you know, Mesa Verde National Park, for example, was one of Theodore Roosevelt's. So he was very keen on saving the Southwest and making us see that that area had special attractions. And he loved the climate and loved his time that he spent in the Four Corners region. As ex-president, he ended up living with a group of Hopi Indians and actually wrote a scientific article about rattlesnakes.
He had significant support in the media for his conservation efforts, did he not?
He did, but he created it. He came in and decided this was my issue. This is what I'm going to be known for. And I can't tell you enough, everybody knew he liked hunting. And it helped him a lot because a lot of Westerners went along with conservation and said, TR's one of us. And he understands a Western land. He didn't look down on Western people. In fact, he celebrated the cowboys and ranchers as the finest Americans he knew. And so they were willing to listen to his ideas of how to preserve a river, not to kill off the river by damming it and killing all the salmon runs out. And he found a lot of people backing his kind of American nationalism, because they knew that it came from the heart, that it was all about the loving of America, the land and the soil and the sky, kind of a hyper-nationalism based on making sure we don't ruin the magnificent sights of the West, and again, leaving them for our children's children to enjoy.
Today we're discussing the wilderness warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. My guest is the author, Douglas Brinkley. You mentioned the national forest that he created in Idaho. I got a kick out of a couple of your quotes. You said at one point, Idaho was God's country to Roosevelt. He virtually turned the state into one vast wildlife preserve. And of course, 69% of our state is national forest, so you're not far from the truth there. And he spent a lot of time up north, I think, in Kootenay and the Selkirks. I guess he loved the Selkirks.
Oh, he loved the Selkirks tremendously. He declared it the prettiest place he'd ever gone. He'd also went up to Moscow, Idaho, and went famously planted a tree. They have a TR tree right in the middle of campus up there, trying to, again, talk about that planting of trees, Arbor Day, they used to call it a lot, were very significant to, you know, get young. He loved the Boy Scouts and get scout troops out there to plant trees. And what he liked about Idaho towns was the beautification efforts, the prettiness of them, the fact that the people that weren't, you know, when you don't have garbage and things laying around like you do in so many cities. He really had a Scandinavian sense of cleanliness of living areas. He was had seen so many bad things as police commissioner in New York that he wanted to make sure a town like Boise was any place where anybody lived had a kind of environmental integrity to it.
Even though this sounds like a one-man show, as we talk about the many different accomplishments of his, he did enable people, and one that comes to mind is Gifford Pinchot. Tell us about the relationship there, the friendship, and what Theodore Roosevelt did to really make Pinchot successful and therefore so valuable to the natural world in America.
Well, Pinchot created the Yale University School of Forestry, but he also studied in France and Germany and brought European forestry techniques to America. He then became under T.R. our first head of the U.S. Forest Service. And Pinchot really was a person that would, he wanted wise use forestry, you know, where you would, yes, you obviously, we need wood products and we need sawmills, but you would do it in a way that wasn't gouging all at once. And today, by today's environmental left, if you like, Pinchot's not much of a hero. They think he was really too close to the timber companies. But T.R. loved him very much because he knew more about how trees grow than everybody. He was a real scientific forester. And T.R. never liked politicians, so he always felt that somebody who was an expert in forestry should be helping a state like Idaho determine how to manage its forest. What does a politician know about forest management? They don't. They're just talking about it or they're picking a side and for their own abilities to be elected, where T.R. thought with forest and waterways, you needed to have the real experts, scientific experts brought into the discussion and placed ahead of fish and game commissions around the country. So Pinchot was Mr. Conservation and Mr. Forester, and it was the tag team of the two. But Pinchot was younger than T.R., but they would wrestle together, and they were almost like a father-son team. And they ran shotgun over everybody on pushing forward their conservation agenda.
And for those of us here in Boise who aren't really that far away from Crater Lake, I believe that he had a role in the creation of Crater Lake, calling Theodore's attention to it, and along with a local activist by the name of William Finley, who I do not know anything about. But again, my point earlier that oftentimes it took somebody local to get their attention.
Well, William Finley... And we're just picking one name out of many, many I write about, but Finley was working the circuit of the Pacific Northwest, particularly birds. And so he was an Audubonner, somebody who would study bird habitat and things, but took wonderful photographs, Finley. And T.R. was always quite susceptible to these photographs, I guess as we all are, of beautiful natural landscapes or of species in peril and the like. And so Finley was able to get an audience with T.R. T.R.'s White House always allowed room for ornithologists, foresters, game management people, mammalogists, mineral rights experts. He enjoyed kind of the conversation over Western lands as many people in the West do.
You mentioned Theodore Roosevelt's interest in birds. He was quite the ornithologist of his day. Could you help us understand how he managed to develop this interest?
It started when he was very young, and he created it. His father was really the progenitor of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. T.R. had an uncle, Robert Barnwell Roosevelt, that created America's first fish hatchery. So it was part of the family tradition, but he fell under the spell of John James Audubon. He became a taxidermist when he was young and started collecting one bird of all of North America that he could. That was in the age when you would shoot the bird to collect it. It wasn't big for nature photography. There was no DNA or bird banding and video cams and all that are involved with bird watching today. And he became a buff and a fan, and he qualifies as a true ornithologist. He wasn't just an amateur. And he wanted every county, really, in America to take their own bird census to keep track of bird populations. He was very fascinated by the migrations of birds and their nesting and breeding areas, and it really was an early pusher of what we call flyways, you know, Atlantic Flyway or the Central Flyway or the Rocky Mountain Flyway, Pacific. And what I have to tell you I admire about Roosevelt, a lot of people gave a lot of agricultural reasons. We need the birds to eat, you know, the insects, and the, which was all sound and made sense. But he also said, look, I want to save these species of birds because they're aesthetically pleasing, and I don't want to live in a life without bird sound. And he wasn't afraid to be the romantic about this. He didn't shut that off for politics. He said, yeah, obviously it's romantic. We're trying to save the whooping crane. But let's do it. We can do it. Let's put some effort into this. It'll matter to have them there. So he was able to talk both political language of all of this, talk rancher language, but also have poetic flourishes whenever he wrote or spoke about nature.
And to do this, he really had to take on industry. He had to take on the manufacture and sale of these high-priced hats with the ornate bird feathers.
Oh, he went. It became called the Feather War. Because what Roosevelt said is you can't have state bird laws. I mean, it does no good for Massachusetts to have, you know, Massachusetts Audubon protect birds when they fly to Florida and they were just being slaughtered willy-nilly. And 100 years ago, every woman listening to this would have probably had her bonnet with ornamental feather on it that you would wear for outings. It could be an egret feather, a heron, even a dead hummingbird. And what was happening is that in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, where they would go to these rookeries, people would go with automatic weapons and just shoot all of the birds, pluck their feathers, leave them in mounds of dying carcasses, and then steal all the eggs. And it was we were losing species galore. I mean, the flamingo had been chased out of Florida. Birds like the Carolina parrot used to be ubiquitous, and it went extinct. The passenger pigeon used to be a billion of them flying about when John Adams was president. When T.R. is president, there are none. It's extinct, you know. And so he was trying to he shut down this feather mafia in Florida by using executive power to declare Pelican Island, Florida, was the first, but to find bird areas and declare it federal-controlled property and deed that land over to the birds. And he ended up doing this executive power routine for 51 federal bird reservations. And that is the birth of U.S. Fish and Wildlife. It's really TR's 51 federal bird reservations. Some, like the Yukon Delta in Alaska, TR created a bird reservation the size of West Virginia. And this is the beginning. Today we have, 550 national wildlife refuges, but they all started with TR's first one in 1903 at Pelican Island, Florida, when he went to shut down the feather mafia.
Well, we've barely done justice to The Wilderness Warrior by Douglas Brinkley, and I want to thank you again, Dr. Brinkley, for joining us for this half hour. But again, there's so much more to be read. Again, Dr. Brinkley, thanks especially for The Wilderness Warrior.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Douglas Brinkley. Next week, Robert Fitz, author of Banzai Babe Ruth, Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination During the 1934 Tour of Japan. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to previous interviews anytime, go to BoiseStatePublicRadio.org or download our free player from the iTunes App Store. Search for Reader's Corner.